Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
A little over 10 years ago, on June 29th, 2007, the very first iPhone was offered for sale. And make no mistake, even if you didn't buy one right away, even if you don't have an iPhone now, on that day, the world we live in changed forever. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The iPhone seemed to fulfill needs and desires we didn't know we had. That was Steve Jobs' objective, after all, and he took pretty much all the credit for this revolutionary device. But while we love our iPhones and the Androids and Galaxies that compete with them, there is a cost to them that goes far beyond what we pay to take one out of its elegant white box and use it to explore the world. Brian Merchant is editor at Vice's science and technology outlet Motherboard. He's also author of the new book, The One Device, The Secret History of the iPhone. He joins us this hour from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. Brian, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for having me.
You note that Americans now use their smartphones for an estimated 4.7 hours a day. That is absolutely astonishing for a technology that did not exist 11 years ago.
Right. Yeah, it's really kind of incredible how sort of seamlessly and rapidly this technology has kind of insinuated itself into our daily lives, into our routines. It's kind of hard to imagine doing a lot of things that we do today, without it. You know, it's really kind of a digital glue that sort of holds together sort of, you know, the modern routine.
So the mythology is that Steve Jobs, you know, dreamed this thing up and no one had thought of it before. But the basic concept for something like an iPhone was predicted before he was even born.
Yeah. I really wanted to get sort of at the deepest sort of kernel of sort of smartphone genesis that I could. So I, you know, sort of traced the lineage of devices like this back as far as, you know, the 1800s. So you have pretty much as soon as the telephone rolls out and becomes popular, you have inventors and futurists and satirists and various voices starting to imagine, you know, what a telephonoscope might look like, a way to sort of combine audiovisual, a way to connect everybody, a way to, you know, really sort of do a lot of the things that the iPhone finally delivered on over 100 years later.
You call the iPhone the foundational instrument of modern life. Do you think ultimately it exceeded what Jobs intended?
Yeah, I think Jobs really was imagining the device as being a more polished, more souped up phone. It was really very simple when it, when it debuted in comparison to what it is now. There was no app store. There was no way, in other words, to load programs on the phone that would allow it to do anything besides what it sort of came shipped with. It shipped with features. So you had a really slick-looking touchscreen-operated device that you nonetheless could make calls with. You could use the internet browser, which was fairly revolutionary because it was a lot better than everything else. And you could do text messaging. But besides the internet browser, there was really nothing functionally that the phone was really doing that was transcendent or was really revolutionary in the sense of the word. It was a really kind of just beautiful, expertly executed cell phone. And Jobs wanted to keep it that way for a long time. For a year after the first phone launched, he wanted to keep it closed off because he loved controlled environments. Since the very beginning of Apple, you know, with the Macintosh, he wanted to be able to control his products from end to end, from the hardware to the software, even going as far as using sort of custom screws that would prevent owners of the devices from tampering with them. So he wanted to keep it closed, and it only transpired that after the fact, after a bunch of developers that wanted to get their hands on this thing, after hackers broke into it and showed the world what could be done if you could, say, have an app store or load programs, and after his executive staff convinced him otherwise, that he finally kind of submitted and allowed the app store to take root. And that's when the iPhone really became the iPhone.
The secrecy practiced at Apple is legendary. I was unaware that there were plenty of things that were kept secret from Steve Jobs.
Yeah. So in a sense, the iPhone began as a secret project, even from him. So there was a core kind of group of really imaginative, really sort of ambitious and experimental designers, engineers, and programmers who started having these very casual but also very under-the-radar meetings. They called the meetings Explore New Rich Interactions, or ENRI. And the goal was to just sort of look at where technology was going and try to examine how people would be using their devices 5-10 years from now. They really thought that as the internet was delivering richer, more robust, more interesting media to people's devices, they would want to be able to do more than sort of use a mouse to point and click and use a keyboard to tip-tap away. So they started exploring new technologies, like something called multi-touch is what they landed on, that is now embedded in every iPhone today. But those meetings were very under the radar, and they kind of worried during those early experimental phases that if Steve Jobs stumbled upon it and, you know, saw this very experimental prototype of a rig that they were kind of hacking together out of Radio Shack parts and technology that one of the guys found in his garage back home, that he would go, what the heck is going on here, and shut the whole thing down. So they kind of had to keep it mum until they could develop the basic sort of foundations of what would become the iPhone, sort of to convince Johnny Ive and then convince him that this was something they should pursue.
Jobs would later not just hint but outright claim that Apple had invented this touchscreen technology that was used in the iPhone. Is there any way to couch that statement so that it's not an outright lie?
Well, so multi-touch is one of those sort of catch-all technologies that has a number of different forefathers. So I guess he benefited from the fact that there isn't one clear inventor. You know, there very rarely is ever one person who we can point to and say, you know, that person did it. They're responsible. So I think he was taking advantage a little bit of the fact that there is ambiguity built into technologies. And I mean, it just makes such a more compelling slogan to say, you know, I think what he actually said was, you know, and it's this brand new technology called multi-touch, and we invented it, and boy, have we patented it. So what really had happened is they had acquired a company started by a really brilliant man named Wayne Westerman, who himself had repetitive strain injuries in his hands that prevented him from using regular keyboards at length. So he sort of engineered his way around another solution, which was multi-touch, that would allow him to sort of combine typing with, like, low-impact typing on this black, you know, pad and swiping to take over some of the more arduous gestures that would allow him to actually do his work. So he started a little company called Fingerworks that Apple acquired in 2005, and it was thanks to his sort of efforts to overcome through engineering his disability and Apple acquiring that company that the iPhone even has this technology in the first place. So there's really no way that Apple can be said to have actually invented this technology, and certainly not Steve Jobs.
How did Westerman come out of that deal financially?
Well, you know, Apple is so secretive that it's really impossible to get a hard dollar figure on it. You know, as soon as Apple made the acquisition, pretty much the next day, his own company went dark, Fingerworks, which coincidentally angered a lot of people, because a lot of people who had the same issue that he did, who suffered from tendonitis or repetitive strain injuries, really relied on his products to, you know, to replace the keyboard so they could do computing. And as soon as it was acquired by Apple, it went dark to the extent that nobody even knew what happened for a long time, months and months, maybe even a year, until the iPhone came out and then the patents were published and people said, oh, that's what happened to Fingerworks. So we don't have a lot of information about how, you know, much Apple paid for that acquisition, or, I mean, he's still working at Apple today.
I didn't get the sense reading this book that the iPhone was inevitable in the form in which it was ultimately delivered, but it did come about at the time it did, in part because there were different technologies and innovations that were simultaneously available. Like, without any one of them, the device that we got wouldn't be the iPhone we have today.
Yeah, that's exactly right. it's really interesting. One of the early chapters, I focus on Frank Canova Jr., who's mm-hmm. a guy that most people have probably never, ever heard of, almost certainly have never heard of. But he, for all intents and purposes, invented the first smartphone. And if I were to sort of describe to you in basic terms what the function of this device was, you know, it's a black rectangle with a touch screen and square apps that you use a touch screen to activate. It has an app store. It has email. It has internet access. You'd say, oh, okay, you're talking about an iPhone. But really, this was the IBM Simon, and it was in the early 90s that he was developing this, and it hit the markets in 1993, 1994, and it was a big flop because technology wasn't ready yet. The idea was there, the blueprint was there, the desire to do something like this was there, but technology wasn't yet. So when I talked to Frank, he told me that, yeah, it's all about time frames. It's all about that sort of fortuitous alignment of different technologies being ready. As you just said, if multi-touch wasn't quite where it was, if Gorilla Glass wasn't quite where it was, if lithium-ion batteries weren't small enough and powerful enough to run this thing, if the ARM, you know, computer processor that was integral, that's really the iPhone's brain, wasn't powerful enough and low energy enough to run it, if any one of those things weren't ready, then we wouldn't have the iPhone.
Lithium-ion batteries came from an unlikely source.
Yeah. The very first lithium-ion batteries were actually developed at ExxonMobil, believe it or not. At the time, Bell Labs was very famous. That, you know, Bell Labs had come out of, you know, AT&T, and it was sort of its research arm, and it was really prestigious, and it was doing a lot of really interesting things. The first transistors that would go on to power the computer revolution were developed there. So Exxon sort of saw that and said, you know what, we can be more than an oil company, and we'll start one of these labs of our own. So they did exactly that. And one of the things they did, they hired this Stanford grad who had been doing battery technology away, Stan Whittingham, and set him to work on trying to figure out ways to improve the battery because, you know, believe it or not, they were worried about the end of oil like a lot of people were at the time. This was the time of sort of the oil embargoes and those oil crises that really sort of rocked the global economy. So they were forced to kind of look at other options. And one thing they thought was like, well, maybe we can make an electric car. So Exxon set him to work developing a battery, and he came up with this lithium-ion battery. And unfortunately, it kept exploding and catching fire. So he never got it to be anywhere close to a commercial product, but others would then take up his work and perfect it and evolve it into the lithium-ion battery we know today.
The Gorilla Glass story is a good example of how Steve Jobs didn't always have great people skills.
Right. Yeah, that's a funny story because he certainly did have what a lot of people call this reality distortion field, where he, you know, feels like he can show up and bend reality to his will. And he, at the very last minute, iPhone had this problem in his eyes, and that's that if everybody was going to be carrying the device in their pockets, the other thing that they're going to carry in their pockets were keys. And at the time, the iPhone had a plastic screen, and these things would just come out looking all scraped up and scuffed up, and it didn't take long for the keys to basically ruin the screen. So he had this kind of this famous moment where he held it up, and it's like, we need to fix this. And we're talking months before the iPhone would roll off the development line. So he had to go fly to Corning, a top glassmaker. And we can talk a little bit more about that, but he basically convinced the CEO through brute will to manufacture this glass that had never been manufactured before in a matter of months.
All right, we'll get the rest of that story in just a minute. My guest is Brian Merchant, editor at Motherboard and author of The One Device, The Secret History of the iPhone. If you'd like to join our conversation, call 1-800-933-5372.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour to Brian Merchant. He's editor at Motherboard, which is Vice's science and technology outlet, and he has a new book out called The One Device, The Secret History of the iPhone. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, Brian, Corning, New York is literally an entire continent away from Silicon Valley, but these guys know what they're doing.
Right. So they are one of these sort of unlikely innovators that have continued to sort of push the envelope in regards to their area of expertise, which is glass. So they have this great sort of history of really experimenting and developing new products. So back in the, you know, the mid 20th century, they had stumbled quite by accident onto this white sort of opaque sort of ceramic glass that they developed into something called Corningware. Now, if you've ever had like a casserole in one of these white dishes with the blue flour, maybe your parents or grandparents served it to you, and then that's Corningware. And it was known for being really indestructible. And it was sort of coming out at the same time as the microwave. So it rose to prominence and gave Corning this huge hit. So their bosses said, well, why can't we do that with something that actually looks like glass, that's translucent? So they embarked on this project called Project Muscle to really develop the strongest shatterproof, scratchproof glass in the world. And they did. They, after this remarkable series of experiments, you know, they're throwing the stuff off the roof of their headquarters to see if it'll break, and it doesn't. It's surviving these great long falls, and then they try to bring it to market and they get no takers. There's some interest from automakers as using it as a windshield, but it turns out it's too strong, because when they put crash test dummies in there and they simulate a collision, their heads crumple instead of breaking the glass. So they had to shutter this operation. So the Project Muscle was for the time a failure, and it sat dormant for almost 50 years until along comes the time to make smartphones. And they start to think about, oh, well, maybe this will be useful for something else. And just coincidentally, just the next year, Steve Jobs has this great demand for strong, scratch-proof, shatterproof glass. So he flies across the country to meet with Wendell Weeks, the CEO, who tells him, like, well, yeah, we've got this glass. We've never manufactured it, but we've got it waiting in the wings. We've had it for 50 years. And Steve Jobs says, no, that's not how it works. I know glass, and it's that's not how it works. And he says, excuse me, I run a glass company here. Let me tell you how glass works. So they have this funny exchange, and it comes out of it. Steve Jobs convinces him to kickstart the manufacturing line, and they really do. They really go head over heel, they bend over backwards to really make this happen. And sure enough, they make enough glass in this plant in Kentucky that's never been made before to cover the first iPhone.
There may be people raising an eyebrow because they've cracked a screen or five, but if you think how thin that sheet of glass is, it really is extraordinary.
Yeah, it is. So when we say shatterproof or scratchproof, we're really talking about, it's not like indestructible, but it will survive. You know, if you scrape it with your keys, you won't see that mark. You won't see a lot of, those sort of invisible interactions that we have over the course of the day, and it survives a lot of drop tests. But yeah, it's still certainly prone to. Lord knows I've broken enough screens of my own to know that it's not actually shatterproof.
So, Brian, I'm in my mid-40s. I started my journalistic career working for a TV station. And at the time, the photographers had these massive cameras that they would carry on their shoulders. Sometimes there was like a secondary pack to have the recorder. And this was, 25 years ago. The idea of putting a high-definition still and video camera into something the size of an iPhone doesn't even faze my kids, but it's a big deal.
Yeah, that's maybe one of the biggest ways that I think that the iPhone has really sort of changed the world, if you will. It's really the ability to take snap photos at any given moment, you know, to take video, to share all this media. You know, it's had massive impacts in terms of, you know, citizen journalism, in terms of, you know, media production, in terms of sort of like sharing this, the way that we've sort of visualized the world is now through a series of mediated screens. And it's funny that they didn't even care about the camera when they were making the first one, really. That's maybe a little much. Of course, they wanted to have a solid camera in there, but it wasn't even really one of the things that they were thinking about. They were kind of, you know, I was told by my sources that, oh, you know, like everybody else had a camera, so Steve said, yeah, we got to put one in. So they kind of did the bare minimum. They put a camera in that was solid, but not great. But then again, once they opened up the ecosystem, the app ecosystem, and let developers have access to that camera, that's when you started to see all these interesting things happening, like Hipstamatic and then Instagram, which probably did more to change the way that we, you know, take photos and that we share photos than Apple itself, which now, of course, as you said, it's this huge sort of field, this arms race almost inside the industry where everybody's got to get the better camera, the better video, the higher resolution. But in the beginning, it was kind of an afterthought.
We still call these things our phones, but did the people at Apple overestimate how much people would make calls and underestimate how much people would do everything else with these devices?
Certainly. Well, at least Steve Jobs did. Again, that was the phone was the most important function to him. He really was thinking of it as sort of an accessory, and so he was really dead set on making the phone sort of, you know, if you watch that very famous first product demonstration, he just spends very little time on stuff like the camera, but then does sort of lengthy demonstrations about how you can merge conference calls or how you can rearrange your address book. So yeah, the thinking was that this was going to be a great phone, you know, along with an iPod and along with a web browser. But the phone was really, really important to him. Also, personally, on a personal level, it was important to him because he hated it when calls were dropped. So he had this sort of like this visceral, intense relationship to his own phones, according to the interviews that I did and a lot of people that were close to him who saw him, you know, smash a phone when he dropped a call or throw it across the room in anger. So it was really imperative that this first iPhone would not drop calls, would function well as a phone.
An iPod. A phone. And an internet communicator. An iPod. A phone. Are you getting it? These are not three separate devices. This is one device. And we are calling it iPhone. Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
And there you have it, reinvent the phone.
Right.
It's funny how that wasn't so long ago, and it seems a little bit quaint now.
Yeah, right? I mean, even that last word, that internet communicator, what is that?
It's like something Captain Kirk would use.
Right. It's right out of Star Trek. So they weren't quite sure how they were going to, you know, do the internet, what they were going to do with it, whether it was just going to be, you know, you open up a web browser and, you know, type in addresses, or again, the app store and that idea of sort of delivering web-based, you know, programs to consumers through that really, you know, intuitive way wasn't on the menu yet. So it was kind of, we're like, yeah, we're going to do internet stuff somehow. It's going to be cool. It was very sort of still in, still incubating.
Another thing Apple did not invent exactly on its own was the text, voice-to-text communication, the technology that enables something like Siri.
Yeah, Siri was the outgrowth of actually, once again, a long sort of legacy of invention and projects. But probably the biggest one was this huge Department of Defense funded effort to create a digital assistant called Kalo, and it was really interesting that they had decided to focus on this, because it was at a time when actually a lot of AI research was kind of going out of vogue. But they were really interested in sort of streamlining the way that you could interact to a computer interface, and they wanted to see if they could, you know, use this as sort of in the battlefield, in like sort of a command station scenario, where you could more efficiently relay orders and sort of keep tabs of logistics and that kind of thing. But this was a huge, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars were spent on this project, which was part of which was done with the SRI outside of Stanford, and they, you know, really came up with a lot of sort of the functions, again, in embryo, that would be, you know, ported over to Siri. So a few of those guys started a startup, and they called it Siri, and it was first an app on the iPhone itself. They had no relation to Apple at first, and they just loaded it onto the App Store. And partly because of the novelty of talking to this interesting robot voice, you know, it became a huge hit, and it was just, you know, a matter of days before they got a call from Steve Jobs. It was one of his very last acquisitions that he was a part of.
Siri always feels like it's just about to work really well.
Right? I think that a lot of things are actually like that, you know, a lot of technologies, but Siri, since it's a voice and since we're so intimately familiar with, you know, vocal communication, and we can see its shortcomings, that it really, I know exactly what you mean. It's never quite giving you the right answer, or never quite opening the right app, or never quite calling the right person. But, you know, it's this perpetual effort to evolve and improve it, doing a variety of different techniques. And now they're doing more sort of neural net stuff, where they're trying to do sort of some of the strategies that, like, Google has done with its DeepMind work.
Why were Jobs and company so resistant, or Jobs specifically, why was he so resistant to the idea of the App Store for such a long time? Was it just about worrying that somebody else would make his product look bad?
Yeah, it was that, and he thought that the very worst thing that you could have happen is, again, if the primary, function of the object is to make a call, and some functionality accidentally impedes that, you know, if some developer makes an app that, you know, accidentally interrupts a phone call when it's running in the background or something, then that, in his mind, would be the very worst thing. Or if some app prevented somebody from calling 911, or if some, you know, app just basically impeded on the experience that he imagined the iPhone presenting. So he, again, had this visceral relationship to cell phones, and to him the call was all important. So if anything got in the way of that, then it was the worst thing that could happen to his product, and he just wanted to control, you know, every element of that experience. And that attitude gives rise to a lot of attention to design detail, but it also impedes things like, you know, opening up the App Store.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is motherboard editor Brian Merchant, who has a new book out called The One Device, The Secret History of the iPhone. You can use any kind of phone to call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also find us on Twitter at KERAThink, or you can email think at kera.org. Brian, what's in an iPhone?
That is a great question. And it's one that, from the onset of this project, I was really interested in finding out, because there are basically layers of answers to that question. So one of the very first things that I did was I got some help from Teardown Engineers, which is this new sort of job title. I mean, it's a great job title, right? Teardown Engineer. And they help people break down their gadgets and teach them to how to repair these really complex looking things. I mean, if you take the screen off an iPhone, and again, you need special tools to do so, because Apple has engineered it in such a way that you can't open it with a regular screwdriver, you'll see that it's this really intricate, complex network of components. There's, you know, the battery's the biggest and most obvious component, and that's on the left. And then you have the logic board on the right, and all sorts of snaking sensor cables, and all sorts of, other chips that are doing different functions. So you basically have this family of chips in there, and you have, a glass touchscreen. And so you can say, okay, you know, there's dozens of those components, from the gyroscope to the computer to the sensor cables and to all that stuff. But then I was curious, like, well, what's all that stuff made out of, too? So I teamed up with a metallurgist, David Michaud from 911 Metallurgy, and he helped me break the thing down and just analyze it on the base chemical composition level. So what are the elements that are actually in this thing? Because they, too, have to come from somewhere. And we did this pretty interesting analysis that finds that, that we found out that, for example, a quarter of the phone is made of aluminum because that's the casing. And you find trace elements of things like arsenic or this or gallium, which is this liquid metal that's inside there. And then you find sort of the more precious stuff. There's gold and silver and copper and tin. And a lot of these things are mined in very difficult places. So that led me to the next step of the chain, and that was looking at where some of the actual stuff that's mined for the iPhone originates from.
What did you find in Bolivia?
So in Bolivia, you know, I was able to go to visit one of the mines that Apple sources its tin. And tin is used, among other things, in the soldering agent, the metal that holds all the components together. And Apple, you know, due to the Dodd-Frank law of 2010, there's an amendment in there that forces companies to list where they get conflict minerals, and tin is considered a conflict mineral. So it listed that it has this smelter in Bolivia, and I was able to link it to a mine nearby that is one of the most famous mines in history. It's called Cerro Rico, or the Rich Mountain, or the Mountain That Eats Men, because over the 400 years or so that it's been running, an estimated 8 million people have died inside of it from cave-ins and silicosis, lung disease.
Say that again. 8 million people have died in this mine?
8 million people. So this mine was used by the Spanish Empire. When it arrived in South America, it found out about this mine, and it conscripted Incan laborers to work there. So there was Incan laborers, there was slaves, there were all kinds of people. And over the centuries, yeah, it's been one of the deadliest mines in the world.
Motherboard editor Brian Merchant is my guest. We're talking about his book, The One Device, The Secret History of the iPhone. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Support for the Think podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Motherboard editor Brian Merchant, author of The One Device, The Secret History of the iPhone. Join us at 800-933-5372. Brian, what did you find out about child labor and the raw materials that go into an iPhone?
So in the mine that I visited in Bolivia, it's a mine that is actually fairly well known at this point to tragically house some child miners. UNICEF did a report about mining in the region, and they found that as many as 6,000 children were working in these mines, and some as young as 6 years old. And the miners that I interviewed there all, you know, confirmed this, and they said that, you know, that's, you don't see the children a lot because they go the deepest, where it's, you know, this is a mine that's been very, very deeply extracted. So it's been hollowed out a great deal. So you have to go into some very serious, you know, nooks and crannies to get some materials out. And that's where children are often sent, and that's where they can get some of the more fertile raw materials. And again, they're using some of the most primitive technologies you can imagine. You know, they're pickaxes and mining by hand, and, you know, those mine carts that you kind of, you know, the stereotypical, you know, old-fashioned mining operations use, that's what this looked like. It's hardly advanced beyond colonial times when this mine was operating at its height. And it is deadly. In 2008, 60 children were estimated to have died in this mine. 60 children in 1 year. And it's a sad reality that a lot of devices, a lot of things are mined in conditions like this. Bolivia is a very poor country. It's very, you know, doesn't have tight regulations on how, these mines are run. So a lot of the tin that is sourced here is mined in these conditions, and then it's sold to a middleman who then sells it to a smelter, who then sells it to an Apple supplier, who then manufactures a product using it, and then, you know, it ends up in an iPhone or also an Android phone or Samsung phone or whatever.
So it's our lifestyle. It's not like we can have a clear conscience if we've purchased another brand of smartphone.
So there are some interesting efforts being made to correct this because, yeah, it is sort of, it's a byproduct of this, you know, global trade system where you have these very porous, very complex networks of resource flows from mineral to component to end product. So it's really hard to police, but it can be done. I recently wrote an op-ed in the LA Times arguing that Apple should do more because it can raise standards, it can be more proactive. Its own code of conduct states that any worker in its entire supply chain should have a right to a safe and ethical workplace. And clearly, you know, a 6-year-old mining tin in Bolivia in this deadly mine does not. So there are solutions. There's a group called Fairphone that began as an NGO campaign to sort of raise awareness about the ethics of sourcing minerals for technology, and then kind of turned into its own company where now they're actually trying to do it. So they mine all but 10 of the minerals in the phone in certified, ethically certified conditions. So they've been able to make great strides, and companies can do more if they are willing to dedicate the resources to do so.
I'm glad we have you with us today because just this morning we heard that Foxconn Technology has plans to build another factory in the U.S., this one in Wisconsin. Foxconn, of course, is the famously secretive subcontractor that assembles iPhones in China. How did you get in there?
You know, it was a stroke of luck that I was able to do that. It was a stroke of luck having a persistent translator alongside me who was really great in sort of at talking to people. So we had spent all day trying to get inside, interviewing workers outside the gates, interviewing their friends, some of whom still worked at Foxconn, some of whom tried to get us in. But there are basically two different kinds of entryways into the big plant. There's the well-guarded main entrance where all the components and manufacturers and the little vendors go in and out that are heavily guarded. And that's where a Reuters journalist was dragged out of a cab and beaten by a security detail just for taking pictures outside the thing. But there are also these smaller entrances where employees can filter in and out with a lanyard. And after spending all day trying to get in, I honestly just had to use the bathroom. And I saw a bathroom like right past this gate, and we thought it was worth a shot. So basically my translator hectored this poor security guard, this young, it was one of the less manned entryways, until he just said, "Fine, just go, but come right back. We'll be watching you. You can use the bathroom, but just come right back." And we just took off and made a dash for it.
So what did you see when you got in?
You see a huge, immense complex of gray, monolithic buildings where people are dwarfed by sort of just the sheer physical manifestation of industry. You see on the outskirts, you know, poorly regulated working conditions. You see some chemicals spill. You see, a lot of construction and hard manufacturing being done under not so great conditions. But then as you get in, you know, remember, this thing is the size of a small city. It houses about almost 500,000 people. The estimates are up to 450,000 people live, work, eat, sleep, do everything in this one factory called Longhua. And in 2010, Longhua was the site of a suicide epidemic. And if anyone's heard of Longhua, that's probably why, because then it was Apple's chief iPhone manufacturer. That's where most iPhones in the entire world were made. And it was a place where the conditions were so psychologically difficult that 14 workers in a very short amount of time all committed suicide in a very public and very tragic fashion.
You know, it's really difficult to deal with this because I think we do all love our smartphones. Brian, I mean, I have an iPad here in the studio that I use as a tool during the show. We would like to imagine them being put together in these well-lit, very elegant factories with people wearing lab coats. That's not the reality of the people who are paid to put these things together for us.
So a lot of them are not in that great of conditions. Some of them, you know, that appearance may be there. And since that epidemic broke out in 2010, wages have risen a little bit. There have been certain superficial amendments made, like the supplying of counselors for people who might be suffering from depression or whatnot. But again, these are very sort of cosmetic changes. The fact remains that this is tedious, difficult, demanding work in a really intense psychological environment, and that hasn't changed. So you have a lot of these laborers coming from sort of rural parts, impoverished parts of China, and then asked to do 10, 12-hour shifts on their feet. And then not only that, but if they screw up, their supervisors are very likely to publicly humiliate them for making a mistake or holding up the production line. And it's this sort of psychological difficulty that really sort of has infested Foxconn's work environment. And that's what I kept hearing about in interviews with workers there. So yeah, so it is a very much an ugly and difficult place to work for anybody. And people don't last more than a year there, typically. Everybody kind of says that they come there and they try to make it out a year and then get a better job. But it is something, again, that, you know, could be addressed more forcefully. A lot of the things has to do with this all but mandatory overtime and just the work culture. If things like that were addressed, then it could go lengths towards improving the conditions that our phones are made in.
Can we assume that Foxconn's U.S. employees will be treated better?
I think we can, if only because the media spotlight is going to be on the plant, shining much more brightly. It's going to want to present a much better picture of how Foxconn runs its operations. You know, Foxconn is such a massive employer in China. It has over 1 million workers in China. It's such a huge part of the economy there that it enjoys a close relationship with the state. And of course, the state controls the media. So it doesn't really have to worry as much about its image in China per se. So here, it's a different story. So it's going to want to make a more elegant, you know, as you said, more modern, fancy looking factory. And sort of, there's definitely going to be an imperative to treat its workers better.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Anne calling us from Austin. Hello, Anne.
Hi. It's nice to talk to you today.
Glad to have you.
I'm calling to let your audience know that Apple has taken the lead in making sure that blind people have access to their technology. So every device comes out of the box with VoiceOver in settings, and it makes it possible for blind people to use all Apple products.
I'm really glad to know that, Anne. What did you learn about the adaptability of Apple products, Brian, for disabled users?
Yeah, you know, she's absolutely right, and I thank her for her call, because that's Apple has done some incredible things in terms of accessibility, and for blind, for visually impaired users, it has really taken the initiative. You know, this is a small market in terms of dollars and cents, but it has done some amazing things with, you know, voice-operated instruction menus and voice interactive user interfaces. And they have really brought this technology to a huge number of people who wouldn't otherwise have access to it. And for that, they deserve a lot of credit. So I do want to make it clear that, yeah, this isn't, this book is not an effort to sort of, you know, expose the dark side of Apple or anything. It's just an analysis of what this device means in both good terms and bad, just the reality of what it takes to make a device, because the iPhone has done a number of incredible things, as well as, incurred some great difficulties and tragedies in its supply line.
Many people who know more about this sort of thing than I am and are in a better position to judge seem to feel like the improvements happening in the iPhone now are more incremental than they were in the early years. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And there are a couple different reasons for that. The first and most obvious being, as Tony Fadell, one of the architects of the iPod and key forces behind the iPhone, told me, if you look at the first phone and how it debuted, that interface, the just how it looks, how you interact with it, and sort of the structure of how the apps are laid out and everything, hasn't changed much. You've beefed up, you've iterated, you've done little things to tweak around the sides, but the basic form, they basically nailed it. And there's a reason that Android basically copies that user interface. And that's that they got so much right in the beginning that it arguably didn't leave them with as much room to make, you know, huge breakthroughs. So you're seeing a lot of little, you know, there's force feedback or the fingerprint scanner and a faster chip and a better camera. So it's, yeah, you're basically improving on what from the get-go was a really solid foundation.
Do you have the sense that, like, our grandkids will think it's crazy that we had to carry around a device in our palms to do the things we want to do on an iPhone?
Yeah, that is the billion-dollar question. I think, you know, our kids, that's getting a little hazy down the in future sight lane. I don't know if I can see that far, but I would say that probably maybe longer than a lot of people suspect we'll be porting around smartphones in our pockets in some degree. Maybe they'll be flexible. Maybe we can, like, roll them out on the table to get a bigger screen when we want to. Or maybe there'll be, you know, interesting ways that we'll engage augmented reality with them. But I would be a little surprised if 10 years out, say, there's something too radically different than the iPhone that's rolling off the assembly lines.
Is it morally wrong to buy a smartphone?
No, not at all. I think that it's, again, I think by sort of investigating that side of how the device is made and telling those stories, we can understand the entire sort of hidden history of what it takes to make a device. And that's what this book is all about. It's examining those hidden histories, the faces sort of obscured by the screen, and sort of getting a holistic picture of really sort of the manpower, the effort, and the sort of blood, sweat, and tears that does go into each and every one. There are things that we can do, you know, we can sort of ask Apple to do a little more in terms of labor and maybe mining, but I don't think anyone should feel bad about owning one. Far from it. I own one. I love it.
Brian Merchant is editor at Vice's science and technology outlet Motherboard. His new book is The One Device, The Secret History of the iPhone. Brian, it's been so interesting. Thank you for making time for us.
Thanks so much for having me. Had a blast.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.